Thank you, Nancy. I want to start by something, by sharing something personal about Nancy. Is that okay? Thank you. it's not that personal. Nancy just got a new job. Congratulations. And just a week before that, Nari just got a new job. So we're family, we're community. And is there anybody else that wants to announce something similar? Like maybe getting fired or something that you're happy about? Some people are happy about that. Okay. This just happened. I think this is good news for our whole community because we're family. And I mentioned that because I had an opportunity to do just to do a little bit of light coaching for these women as they were going through this transition and just remembering some basic things about who we are and where we get our value. Like, what are we worth? And it's just so easy in the society that we're in to find our sense of worth and value in credentials, jobs, salaries, benefits, position, respectability, reputation, things like that. And it was just a wonderful opportunity to remind ourselves of where our value comes from. That's what the church does, right? We don't like directly do job training or things like that, but we remind ourselves who we are, who we belong to, and where we get our worth. And I'm just grateful that every once in a while we get to have focused conversations about that, depending on where we are in life, but that in general, our congregation is all about remembering those things. So our parenting retreat, it's not an easy thing to talk about because it brings up a lot of joyful memories, I'm sure, but also painful memories as we think about our upbringing with our parents. And then those of us who are parents of our own children, and, you know, I'm one too, and think about mistakes that we've made, and we're thinking about mistakes we're making right now as we speak. And so it's a tough thing. But one thing we want to do is help us to understand how much of this is our own personal failure and how much of it is just the toxic social context that we're living in, so that we can distinguish that and those things that we lament together about the context that we're in, we do well, and those things we can take personal responsibility and agency and move forward in a healthier way, we do. And then especially taking collective responsibility. I mean, if you look around this room, it's just such a wonderfully diverse representative of our congregation. And some of us have our own biological or adoptive children, and others don't. But we all recognize that we have a mutual commitment to raise children together, and that we ourselves are children that are to be raised collectively in this church village. I want to talk a little bit about differentiation and kind of introduce that concept, because we'll be talking about that a lot as kind of really a personal goal that we can move toward for ourselves personally, but also collectively. What does a differentiated person look like? What does a differentiated congregation look like? What does a differentiated family look like? So differentiated comes from the word different, and it basically means I'm me and you're you. So that does that sound like a simple concept? Yeah, we're good. We're done? Okay. I'm me and you're you. Anybody want to comment on that? What does that mean for us? And are we living into that, or is it difficult to live into that? Difficult. Can you say why, Daniel?
So full disclosure, I'm one of the leaders. So Ken and I and Rebecca Schultz-Jackson and Daniel Schultz-Jackson have time to process all of these things. I think I learned that I'm an over-functioner, and as an over-functioner, I always expect people to function at my level, meaning do things right, do them fast, be effective. Why are you not involved in X, Y, Z? And I had not realized it until Tuesday night, and I was like, oh, that's what's happening. That's why I get angry and upset at people who are not doing enough in my world. Mm. But then I have to remember, oh, I am over-functioning, so it's on me. So mm-hmm. I think that the self-differentiation piece comes from like understanding that not everybody will be doing the things as you would do on yourself.
Very good. That's an excellent example. So, your problems are yours and not Kendra's is basically what we got, right? It's a very, very difficult concept to come to. If we're differentiated, here's like what it looks like. I'm fine by myself and I don't need you to help me feel fine. That's actually how a differentiated person feels. Right? It doesn't mean that I don't care about you or you don't care about me. It means that my equilibrium or sense of balance, sense of being okay, does not depend on how you feel about me. This is actually also the formula for a happy and healthy marriage. Because it's enough for a person to feel fine on their own, much less carry the load of somebody else feeling fine. That's actually not even possible. We human beings don't have the capacity to actually help another person feel fine. That role belongs to God. Only God can help us really be fine. And that kind of weight put on a spouse is really unsustainable. And then that kind of stuff is often put on the children. So why are many of us not differentiated or poorly differentiated or codependent, meaning needing other people to be okay? It's probably because our parents were not differentiated and needed our emotional functioning in some way for them to reach their equilibrium. In other words, they're kind of leaning like this and they needed their spouse. I mean, it's always the same thing. They needed a combination of spouse and children to stand up straight, right? So then those children who grow up in codependent family systems, then themselves don't feel balanced. They don't have an equilibrium. They're like this, and then they're looking for a spouse to help stand up straight, and even that doesn't quite work. Then you have children, and that never works either. So codependent systems are like people leaning into each other. So if it's as simple as that, if a healthy functioning system, emotional system, is about people standing up straight, why doesn't everybody just do that? Why don't people differentiate, which is the key to health and happiness? Well, because when you're in a codependent system and one person decides to differentiate, it can cause the collapse, emotional collapse of other people who are dependent on that person. Right? Imagine 2, 3, 4 people leaning on each other like the poles in a teepee, and one pole stands up straight, the others can easily collapse because it depended, it was a codependent relationship. So often when one person in a family system differentiates, that person is accused of being a bad member of the family. Even someone who betrays the well-being and the happiness of a family, and especially someone who is selfish. Okay, maybe it's good for you, but what about us? You know, for years, maybe decades, we've learned to function in this codependent way. It's not healthy, it's kind of gross, and we often set each other off, and we often don't talk to each other for days, and then yell at each other for days, and, you know, back and forth, and it's not pretty, and, you know. But here we are, and we're still family, at least. We're still family. And isn't that better than being alone? And now you're going to differentiate and abandon us? So that's how codependent people feel when one person in the emotional system self-differentiates. It feels like emotional abandonment. So there's an incredibly powerful pull. You've heard of the proverbial crab that tries to get out of the bucket, and other crabs just clamp down, and you think you're better than us? Huh? You think you're better than me? That's why self-differentiation is almost impossible in codependent systems, whether it's a nuclear family or a government, corporation, church. Codependent systems are always easy to tell because people need each other, right? When you need another person to have equilibrium, then you're in a codependent system. So, of course, you know, there's different ways of understanding the word need. We all have mutual need. I mean, we have to share cooking and cleaning and paying bills together and all that. But I'm talking about this leaning emotionally and not feeling okay without the other person leaning back into us. That kind of need and that inability for us to be okay on our own means that we have not fully self-differentiated. So that's what it may look like in a family. And we're trying to ask the question, can we, instead of just one of us on the path to differentiation, what if all of us were on the path to differentiation at the same time so that we don't cause other people to feel like we're abandoning them, right? But that we're in this together and we're all standing up together. This also happens in the workplace, and that's why I mentioned these two ladies as an example, that I don't mean that. I mean, like, we can have, all of us can have codependent relationship with a broader society. For example, what if you're okay doing some simple woodworking, and let's say that pays $30,000 a year, but your parents and your siblings are all in this like high-powered, go-getter professional jobs, most of them making six figures, right? And you're the one person in your whole family systems that's doing like wood carving or whatever for $30,000 a year. You're happy with that. You're living in a tiny house or something and you don't need a lot of stuff. But everybody else in your family says you're a loser. And maybe you went to a good college and all your college buddies say you're a loser. Like, why are you wasting your time doing that when you could be doing this other thing and being successful? That's also a codependent environment of an entire society. Now, a differentiated person would say, actually, I'm okay doing this, and I'm living just fine making $30,000 a year. So thank you for your concern, but I'm happy as I do this, right? But very often, that kind of person will take on a job, take on a lifestyle, take on debt, take on mortgage, whatever, so that they can be okay in the codependent system of the broader society who has expectations of what okay looks like. So in other words, a self-differentiated person defines for her or himself what okayness is. A codependent person is relying on other people to define what is okay for me, right? Not even for them, but for me. Now, all children are born codependent on mom, and sometimes on dad. If we're lucky, but so it's designed that way. But healthy parenting leads to self-differentiated children growing into adulthood, right? But in most codependent family systems, the children grow up to replicate codependent ways of functioning as adults. So then the parents are codependent on the children. So the children are codependent on the parents, not just as infants and as young children, but right into teenage and adult years. It's especially in the teenage years that the children must learn to self-differentiate without the opposite ends, codependence or independence. Teenagers are not designed to be independent. But they need to come out of the codependence of early childhood and move into self-differentiated interdependence, right? So interdependence is a sweet spot, but codependence is early childhood, codependence in early childhood leads to codependence in adulthood unless we have a healthy differentiation that leads to interdependence in the middle, and also avoiding independence which is not in mutual relationships with others. So we're advocating for mutuality. So one way I try to visualize this is codependence looks like two codependent people are people leaning into each other like this. And you desperately need each other, and you also can't stand each other, right? Anybody know that feeling, right? You desperately need each other, and you can't stand each other in alternating waves. Intimacy among self-differentiated people looks like this. So you're standing on your own two feet, and this person is standing on their own two feet, and then they come together absolutely intimate, right? But even when their whole bodies are completely together, right? Absolutely intimate, their weight is held by the earth, right? This, think about how much weight of the other person you're bearing. But when you come together like this, the earth is still bearing all your weight, and you have the freedom to be as close and as intimate as you want to be with the other person. You have total freedom to enter into intimate relations. So we are caught in codependent nuclear family system that leads right into spitting us out into a codependent societal system. So it takes enormous conscientiousness and intentionality for us to break out of a system that pretty much has an emotional lock on the ways that we function, whether in the nuclear family or in the broader society. And that's what we're trying to figure out, is how to move all of us to healthy differentiation so that marriage can actually be more intimate, less aggravating, actually closer without being more burdensome. In codependent relations, we still want to be closer to our spouse, but the problem is the closer we get, the more we're leaning into each other and the more weight that the relationship has to bear. So differentiation is actually key to intimacy. Differentiation is intimacy without the cost, right? So let me just stop there and see if we're kind of on the same page of what we're trying to accomplish now as a congregation. In our individual relationships, but also I hope we can see that this is how we try to function as a congregation, right? We try as a congregation not to have codependent relations with our members, to be intimate without needing each other in codependent ways. So it's kind of a trick. I mean, it's tricky, is what I'm saying. It's not a trick. It's tricky, you know, because how do we say to people, we love you, but we don't need you? By the way, in codependent systems, I don't need you is like cursing. But in differentiated family systems, I don't need you is a blessing. Because the second thing you say after you say, I don't need you, is I like you and I want you in my life, right? I don't need you, I want you. That's healthy differentiation. That's what we're trying to say as a congregation to our members. This congregation doesn't need any particular person, but we want every single person. We just enjoy and delight in each person here as part of the family. But you're not here to support the church. The church is here to support each other in loving and free mutuality. And we're trying to model as a congregation what we hope our members enter into in our own emotional systems, whether it's home or work or wherever it is. So let me just stop there for a little bit and for a few minutes do a little back and forth on some basic concepts about codependence and differentiation. This is a family meeting, so it doesn't have to be a question, but just something that we're struggling with, or a question that we want to ask out loud, or something that has been helpful to us that we might want to share with a broader family here.
Yeah, I was reading a couple of days ago about, you know, where Jesus says it's easier for a camel to enter through the eye of a needle than for the rich to enter into the kingdom of God. And I got stuck on this idea about entering into the kingdom of God, because, you know, the kingdom of God, Jesus keeps saying it's present, it's with us. And so you got this weird image of the kingdom being right there in Israel, even while the Romans are also right there with their empire and their kingdom. He keeps saying there's this kingdom and you must enter it, but then it's there. And so we're all standing in it, but are we really in it? And so as he was talking about that and talking about entering it, I've been thinking a lot about just the life that we're trying to lead here as a church. And I do agree. I think self-differentiation is, you know, it's a big part of the life that Jesus wants for us. And I think entering into the kingdom of God, that's a piece of it. The being able to live in relation with each other and even with those who are closest to us, our family, the ones who are the most intimate with us, in a way that's not making them the idol, not making them into God, but instead is letting God be God and then uplifting them and loving them and loving them in a true way. And so what I'm trying to add to this conversation is just saying, I think what Pastor Jin is saying is part of what Jesus is saying in terms of entering into the kingdom of God. So I just wanted to add that in.
All right. Thank you, Ben. Shane?
Yeah, I mean, on top of what Ben's saying there, this is a concept that I've explored a lot. We'll talk more about that tomorrow. But, you know, we talk about empire here, Jin, and I think one of the things that helps me understand is that, like, empire's way, if I'm understanding correctly, is very coercive. That's like, this is how you should live or have to live. And when you think about it in that way, like, kind of the language you're using in relationships, that kind of an enmesh system is coercive. You have to be this way, and or else there are consequences. And that kind of systemically, empire kind of functions the same way. You have to live this way, coercive. So it's kind of top down, and it's almost like love. That's kind of what love is. It's coercive. You have to look like a mean servant. What you're inviting us to, I think, is like a non-coercive form of love, which is much more dangerous because it's not controllable. And I can't control you. I have to let you be. And I have to tolerate the ambiguity of that. And then we actually have to choose each other. But that's not really allowed in a coercive system, like an empire or a coercive system like a family. And so for me, it was a significant paradigm shift to think about relationships this way. But it's helpful for me to try to put in theological lens as well. And help them that's doing that injustice, you know, better scriptural minds will be able to tell me otherwise. But when I think about the language of empire, that helps me understand why I try to be that way with my own life and my kids. I don't want to have coercive love, I want to have free love. And that's difficult.
Yeah. Anyone else?
Well, I think for me, as I've been able to differentiate specifically from my mother, I've in the last 3 months, we've actually now, as I've been more differentiated, been actually meeting weekly. So like I've differentiated, but now there's more intimacy with her than I've ever had. Like before, it was like arguments, like disagreements, and like us getting super hurt by each other, like in our differences. But now it's like we're able to come together and have a discussion and still disagree a lot, but be more intimate and loving towards each other. So it's been a really cool, like 3-year journey for me, really. And now coming, I'm definitely not there yet, but it's just been beautiful to actually have a more fuller love for a person and it to be like what Shane was saying, a free love that wasn't there before. So
wonderful example. So yes, our church is about free love. You heard it from Stephen. Oh, wait, who's clapping to that? Somebody's got a standing ovation. We haven't had a woman's perspective.
Thank you for me.
Yeah. Susie. Sister Susie.
Okay, so not everybody knows, but my oldest, Raina, actually has autism. And so I've been doing a lot of work to figure out how to parent an autistic daughter. Some of the, before the diagnosis was in, I was still trying to make her conform a lot to acceptable standards, and also seeing it as a reflection on my parenting. Like, if she shows up at church all scrubby with her hair not brushed, like, y'all are gonna think that I'm like a slacker parent. And honestly, it's just she doesn't want to do that stuff, you know? And I have to just, you know, pick my battles and let bygones be bygones. And so there was the self-differentiation component is that we've been working on radical acceptance, that I have to accept her exactly as she is and stop imposing on her what my idea of a good, obedient daughter is. And so I have to accept Raina for what Raina is. And that pisses me off sometimes, and I don't like it. And I want her to be the well-controlled, emotionally controlled child that will show up bright and shiny to church and make me look good, you know? But that's not happening. And so I have to accept that it is what it is, and that if she doesn't do those things, that I cannot in any way show her any less love or affection or any kind of show of acceptance to her, because she'll interpret that and she'll read that. And I need to keep that love flowing to her regardless of how she behaves that day.
What I appreciate about this church is that it's never too late, because, I mean, we're past where all of you are with your kids, and you have chance to change. And I know we made a lot of mistakes. And I'm listening, I'm just like, oh my goodness. But it's not too late. And I just appreciate that and the acceptance. And the fact that two of our kids now come to this church, and they're going to be sharing too. And but it's never too late, and God's grace is wonderful.
Thank you, Nancy. By the way, about Raina, I never thought she looked scruffy. Jim Bear, on the other hand, that's a different story. Oh, okay. That does not reflect on Susie. Yeah. Jim Bear needs to own his own scruff. That's, you know, that's his scruff, not our scruff. One of the keys to differentiation is trying to figure out what is arbitrary. And you know what is such a beautiful thing about a multicultural church is it brings to light the particularity of our own culture. What is obvious and eternally true and universal for all people, places, and times, from what we learn, seems actually quite particular when we mix with all kinds of people from all over the world, as we do here. It happens to be Korean culture, right? But my parents said, any sensible person, anybody with half a brain knows that all human beings are supposed to think, act, and behave like this, right? And so when we like that way, then we need to be in a homogeneous environment. But being in a diverse environment means all kinds of things that we thought were universally valid are actually particular to our background. So then we have to ask, and this is why God is so important, like, what is okay with God? Does God need our hair to look a certain way? Does God need us to have a certain kind of job? Does God have a minimum income threshold for us to be an acceptable and contributing member of society, right? If I'm okay with God, then I'm okay. So to be grounded, to be self-differentiated, is to understand my worth vis-a-vis God, period. This is why faith is so important. And Susie, you were talking about Raina and her ADD? Autism, I'm sorry, her autism. Like, will there be such a concept as autism in heaven? And is God okay with that? If God is okay, then she's okay, right? So self-differentiation means rooting myself in God. And unless I am hurting someone or something in violation of God's harmonious creation, then everything is fine. Then we're just violating somebody else's arbitrary and particular notions of what should be okay. And in a healthy family, we remind each other and are honest about that which is particular to me and that which is actually something that God teaches. So, I mean, as a pastor, I can kind of sneak in all kinds of things as God's will with my children, right? Doesn't work with Sinbeck, but I can, I can try to do that with the children, but I have to be really careful because sooner or later, they're going to like figure out that those things I claimed for God are actually my particular preferences that I, you know, kind of shoved in there. One of the things that Sunbeck and I said long, long time ago when we've been married 21 years now, is we're going to be okay if we're homeless and we lived wherever as long as we're together, right? I mean, do we look like the kind of people that would enjoy homelessness? You know, have you been to our house? It's not that I'm not serious about that. It's that it is a dare that we've set for ourselves that we have to constantly live into. When we get anxious about paying bills and about keeping up with the mortgage and about the kind of lifestyle that we've constructed, we need to remember the commitment we made decades ago that we're going to be totally fine as long as we have each other to love and to hold and to cherish. Then we don't need things from each other, like certain kind of job and income and a certain level of lifestyle, right? Because we have committed ourselves to radical flexibility and just being happy with who we are. So, I mean, I hope that we don't ever become homeless or we like the tiny house concept. I'm not sure how comfortable we'd be in one, actually. We like the house that we're in. We like the, you know, suburban middle-class lifestyle. But still, it's really important for us, for the practice of differentiation, for us really to live into the dare we set for ourselves, that we can live in any condition, with any income, in any context, as long as we genuinely love God and love one another and help build a loving community around us. That's just another practical way of living into differentiation so that we're not constantly demanding something of each other to fund a certain kind of lifestyle, which is completely arbitrary, right? We like our lifestyle, but we're also very clear that a suburban lifestyle in America is just one of hundreds and thousands of ways to live. It's an arbitrary lifestyle. It is not God's will for all humankind. And it's a very interesting process for us now to raise our children to say, this is the biggest house you should ever live in for the rest of your life. And you should be on a different track than we've been on our whole lives. And that's also one of the great benefits of differentiation, is actually to lead our children in a different direction than we ourselves have been on, in a good way, in a really good and healthy way. So I'll stop here. Thank you all for being here. I'm so glad that a good portion of our church family has come together. And I especially thank Nancy, our fearless leader. Yeah. And we're going to have a testimony from, should we start with Angela? Okay. Angelina Chepsiror.
Good evening, church. I think many of you know me, Angela Chepsiro, and we've been in this church for a while, since Brooklyn Park until now, and this is where we call home, and this is where we raise our children. I'm married to Joseph. I think most of you know him. He's an elder, and we have three kids, Francis, 13, Esupat is 11, and Daniel is 7. So I just wanted to share, I know I wrote this piece of paper, but it doesn't even make sense because what I was going to share is not even in this paper anymore because things change. And I'm just going to share from my heart the challenges and the joy that I face as a raising a family away from home. I'm originally from Tanzania and married to Joseph from Kenya. And as we all grow up, I thought I'll be close to my mom, my sisters, extended family for extra help. So there are some things that I learned to cope with being away from home. And at the same time, I rejoice in the friends that God has given me to get through what I'm doing right now and I continue to do. So this is the first time my husband is gone for 2 weeks to Kenya, and I'm very happy for that. But at the same time, I thought I had faced more challenges, but it's not true. Being a single mother is not easy. For sure, I work full-time. I think most of us do. And I go to school. I just started going to school again full-time and having kids. So I thought I was challenged enough, but I think now it's more. So tonight I was like, I have to prepare this speech, but I said, let me share from my heart because it's a more true testimony of what I'm going through. And I can say that no matter what we go through, each parents, we have different kids and different ways of dealing things. You're not alone. God is there to help us. And God help us through our friends, our family, if you have family within reach. So those are the hands of God reaching us. And we should accept it and use to get the lessons and be able to raise this healthy family we are looking for. We're all looking for a healthy family. So for me, I returned back to school right after college. I finished 4 years, and then I didn't get a job when the area was done. So I was like, oh, maybe I'll start. I started with Francis, and then I said, I have to go back to school. So I went into healthcare, where I'm a nurse now. But all the challenges I faced raising those kids, and the same time doing homework, and the same time working, and the same time creating time to come to church, I mean, I rejoice in every moment. I don't regret, because God helped me to get through, and I feel happy with the result of it. Because through God, everything is possible. Sometimes you look at things and say, oh, how am I going to get this? But just cool down. Let God walk through. The Holy Spirit will find a solution for your problem. And but most thing that I found helpful in marriage is working together. And I'm referring to my husband, because when I was in school, I go to school all day, I go to work, and then I come home, the house is clean, he cooked, he took care of my little girl hair, which I was first doubting, how is he gonna put this, comb this African hair? But he did it all. He learned to put ribbons, he learned to make even chapati, which is most African men, we don't make certain food because it takes time and a lot of creativity. So I really want to celebrate with the partner I have and thank God for that. And also knowing that he helped me because he knew there's a hope of what I'm doing. He put trust in me that when you are done, we all as a family are going to rejoice in it. So that's the part I said, working together, it helps you get through, even when it seems a lot of difficulties, but teamwork is important. Always the same we say at work, but even at home, teamwork. Don't say, like, I can't fold the laundry. Learn to do the laundry, because your wife may be doing something important, either for the kids or for all of you, for your future. So I've been in that journey, going to school and going balancing work, and, you know, many people say, when are you getting done? And I said, when my heart say I'm done. Because you know what? I have a little comment on that is, my grandma came to live with us when I was like age of probably 5, and she was blind, my grandma from my dad's side. So when she came to live with us, I learned to walk my grandma. I was young, but I learned to take my grandma through the obstacles on the road. You know, like in Africa, there's no paved sidewalk, there's no all that, but I was the youngest in the family, and everybody's in school, boarding school, so I remain at home with my grandma. And the time reached when I need to go to school, my grandma said, Angela, you're not going to go to school because you are my eye. And then I said, maybe I have to stay home with my grandma. But my parents talked to her, and she blessed me. She said, Angela, you go to school, somebody else will train my sister-in-law, because at the time my brother got married. She'll learn to take me through. She trusted me more than grown-ups in the house, because I think I just learned what grandma wants, what to tell her. And we work really along with my grandma. So I keep up my dream that I want to study as long as God given me the power and as long as I'm able to. It's not like I have, if I end tomorrow and I don't want to study, that's fine. But when you have a focus, the point is when you have a focus on what you're looking for, it's easy for you to keep going because there's a light at the end of the tunnel. So always like, I know this, I have to go for 2 more years or 4 more years, but I know I'll be done and I'll be happy and look the positive side, no matter what you're going through. So I want also to know as parents, let us know our resources because it can be a family, can be a friend, and those are the people that help us. That's God walking through those people. So when you're going through challenges, you're not alone. There are people who've gone through that and we continue to go through that. Right now we are going, the kids are growing, we reach teenager, we deal with teenagerhood and we go on adulthood when they're deciding career and marriage and all that. So in every process, there's a challenge, but overcoming the challenge is what we need to know. What can we do to overcome it in the positive way? So that's all I have to share. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Angela. All right, are the Ranghams ready?
Thank you. Yeah, she'll be up here. Yeah. I'm okay with this because I don't need her. That was my first lie of the night. So, I'm actually really glad that Nancy initially introduced us as not being chosen because we have it all together. Because I think that's very true. And that is sort of an idea that I try to defeat whenever I'm able because I feel that I get that perception from people from time to time. So anytime you want to just, you know, put me in my place, that's all good with me. But listening to Pastor Jin talk about differentiation made me think of a lot of different conversations that I've had through this church, some directly with Pastor Jin. I remember a lot of different conversations about family and being able to be your own person. And even before we had children, having conversations, planting the seeds with how we were going to raise children in this context, in the idea that if you truly think this way, if you truly behave this way, how are your children going to turn out? And that's really weighty stuff. And now that I am a parent, I can say it's super weighty stuff. It's really hard to deal with these ideas. And what I'd hope that I can do is take some of those concepts and make it applicable to my life. And I think that that also is very challenging to do. You know, we had school conferences recently. People had conferences. How many people who have kids had conferences that went really well so far? All right?
One person.
One person. Okay, that counts? Yeah. So we sat down with Oliver's teacher, and we were tense about it because we had been in Europe for a week and had missed the last week leading up to conferences. You know, you always want to make a good impression right before conferences so that when the teacher, you know, goes to do her evaluation, she's like, oh, actually, you know, the last 2 days have been really good. So I had no influence over those first couple days before conference, and that made it a little bit terrifying. Oliver's teacher said things like, he's really good at reading, he's, you know, math, and he reads in two languages now because he's at a Spanish immersion school, and he knows his numbers, and he's made a friend in class. You know, a new kid came, and, you know, he made friends with her, and, you know, that was a big important step. All that stuff rolled right off my head. Because she also said that he was sitting in the lunchroom and he got everyone's attention and said, who here doesn't like Cohen? Cohen, another child, Cohen. And that kind of hit hard. And it made, you know, again, she said lots of great things about Oliver, right? But what really stuck with me was that for two reasons. One is because I swear I tell him every day, the most important thing is to be kind to other people. But it also makes me think, like Susie was saying, you know, it's a judgment back on me. And it made me think really hard about whether or not I truly demonstrate that for Oliver. Do I really show him or do I just tell him, Oliver, it's most important that you are kind to people, but does he see me not being kind to people? Possibly. Does he see me rewarding him for other behaviors? I mean, we love when he reads things and, you know, when he does his math things right. I mean, we try to encourage that, of course, like everyone does. But when it comes down to it, is that what he believes is really most important? And I think that's why it sat with me so, you know, badly. And another random thought connecting these tangents is it also made me consider, if that's the case, so let's pretend for a minute that I have not demonstrated this well enough for Oliver and that I really do reward him, you know, for a different set of ideals. That's really what it comes down to. It's not the behavior of reading. It's what's behind that. It's the ideal that his security or importance or even worth is tied up in his scholastic ability, right? That's what I'm really trying to get at here. So if that's truly the message that he's absorbing, it makes me wonder, where did I get that message? And how did my experiences lead me to parent Oliver in that particular way? And that also is something that's really hard to deal with. It requires confronting our childhood, confronting our parents. All sorts of emotions come with that, all sorts of intellectual arguments, you know, contradicting arguments about whether or not it is truly okay that our kids do well in school or don't do well in school. And to reflect on whether or not I am really okay with that is difficult because I did grow up in a context where it was important to do well in whatever capacity. And I feel like that is truly a part of my identity. Like I own that I'm a very competitive person and that if I want to succeed at something, I will succeed if I'm pitted against someone to try and succeed. And I know this about myself, and there are times I really need to resist it. But I know that, and I accept it as part of my identity, but it is not something that I want to build into my children's identity. And that is really difficult. So, like I said at the beginning, I have no answers, and the best that I can do is just be open and honest and ask you guys to help challenge this conversation and challenge these narratives as well as we're being reflective. So those are my thoughts for now, and I'll let my wife speak.
Awesome. Oh, you're just gonna run. He's starting away. Did you introduce us at the beginning? Amanda, Steve Rangham. I think it's important because I know some of you really well. There's a lot of you I don't know that well, truly. You know, where maybe Steve and I are kind of a part of the wallpaper here. We've become a little bit of a CAN institution. Sometimes I feel like, but as far as just like day to day building intimate relationships, especially with having a new baby the last year and a half, I feel like we very easily become a little bit relationally disconnected, or it's not always easy to get to know us. So there's a couple things I think it's maybe helpful to know about us. We're coming up on 9 years here at Church of All Nations. Steve and I have been married for 13 years. We're 35 years old, so I think sometimes people age and demographic us in kind of odd ways. You know, I think sometimes we come across as older than we are or younger than we are. I guess my point is that I can pretty much guarantee that unless you know us, whatever you think about us or whoever you think we are is probably inaccurate. Whether you think we've got it together, or whether you think we don't, or whether you think we're really amazing people, or whether you think we're super faithful because Steve's an elder. Steve didn't go to church ever in his whole life and still is kind of a flaky Christian, in my opinion, but he's an elder. He's an elder at our church. So I tell people all the time, he's a church elder, but he's more of a politician than he is a spiritual leader, which is true. But I think to
I just want you to know that about us, because for me, the real gift that I can give you is not what I know about parenting or what I have to offer because of my relationship or my wisdom or whatever, but the gift that I know Steve and I really have a heart to share is just authenticity. We want to be vulnerable and we want to be open with you in a way that's non-exploitative. I don't want to dump on you. I can do that. I'm very capable of emotional dumping, but that's not my heart and my goal. But what I continually try to offer when I'm in a healthy mind state is my vulnerability. So what I want you, if you take one thing away as far as who Steve and I are, I want you to know that we are always accessible to you. If you want to know about our lives, if you want to know what we're really thinking, if you want to know how I really feel about being a mom, I will tell it to you in my most honest and real terms, and will try not to hide. I'm not a hider, and neither is Steve. And we really believe that the greatest gift that we've been given by this congregation is just the authenticity of the families who we've walked with here. And by you sharing your lives and your struggles openly and honestly with us, we've been able to, I think, walk a little straighter and a little bit more authentically. So it's really our heart to give that back to you. So if there's one thing that I could do tonight for this retreat or for this group, it would be to just create the space for us to be safe and for us to share and for us to be together in a really intimate but not codependent way. So that's really, if I had one goal for speaking tonight, it would be to just help set the tone for this space, to make it sacred and to make it safe. That's really important to me. So with that in mind, you really can ask us anything, and we will tell you probably more than we should. I was thinking, I've got a number of thoughts rattling around my head. Couple things. I thought maybe just building a little bit on Steve's testimony, I think it's maybe really relevant to kind of hear my side of that, because I think that in some ways, I think maybe Pastor Jen had us speak tonight, because I think in some ways we are poster children for codependence and dysfunctional processing. But for me, one of the hardest things about being Oliver's mother is the self-differentiation, is realizing that every single thing that he does or every single one of his achievements or failures isn't my identity. I haven't figured that out yet, but it is brutal as parents to separate and to realize. I was telling Steve when we did this conference, I would rather have a root canal than go to school conferences, because I feel like my worth is on the line and I don't know how I'm going to be hit. And being told that my child is unkind or that he can't behave or that he can't be quiet, I don't differentiate from that. I don't think of it as I'm on Oliver's team and how are we going to help my six-year-old, who's pretty innocent, work through these really minor developmental challenges. I think I'm a terrible person. I'm a terrible mother. I have failed. I am doing it all wrong. I haven't given him enough attention. The entire toxic narrative that goes through my head the minute somebody tells me something basic. Oliver was using naughty words in Nari's Sunday school class. It immediately strips me to my core personally. And I think just sharing that, I hope it's maybe helpful, just because I think sometimes when we can name it, we can start to dig away at it. I think one of the most, I'm going to say, powerful, good, challenging, painful with Pastor Jen, it's always like both sides, right? It's like it sucks, and then you feel kind of good about how bad it sucked to have to confront some of these things. But one of the things that we really struggled with, Oliver had a terrible start with kindergarten last year. I went through a really thoughtful and intentional and corporate process to pick a great school for him and, read all the reviews, went through 6 lottery systems, enrolled him in a great school, spent $200 on uniforms, got him in. Kid completely derailed. And some of it was my fault. He wasn't getting enough food for lunch. He was on the bus for too long. He was exhausted. He wasn't getting a nap. Basically, like, you name it, and it went wrong. He had a bad teacher. He had a bad class. He was getting picked on. He was throwing full-on tantrums in school. I mean, so basically, like, all of my amazing mothering up until that point was suddenly on trial, and I failed. Everything went wrong. And it wasn't Oliver figuring out what was right for Oliver. It was me feeling completely exposed and like a complete failure. Like I had made every decision wrong. I hadn't understood him. I was being called daily by the teacher and basically being told that my son was, you know, basically the worst kid in her class. And the thing is that when you have that moment where you just feel like, what have I done wrong as a mother? It's excruciating. And what was really interesting was, and I'm kind of a little bit circular here in my logic, but Pastor Jen kind of sat us down, and there were a lot of things that came out of that conversation. But one of the things that really came out wasn't just about the differentiation. This is what I wanted to share. It is about how we were parenting Oliver as though he was somehow a byproduct of us, that we were trying to show that we were strict, and we were trying to show that he could be achieving, and we were trying to do this, and we were trying to follow all the parenting rules and make him into a good kid. We were trying to do it all right. And somehow we missed the boat on loving our five-year-old as an absolutely sacred and integral part of our family. And to have that called out was such a slap in the face, because I love my son, you know, probably more than anybody else on earth. And to be told that I was actually parenting him in such a way that I was making him feel like a subhuman part of my family was so, so painful to actually hold up that mirror and to realize that the way I treat my husband, the way I talk to Steve, the respect that we demonstrate in our marriage, that none of that we were pouring into Oliver. We were just cranking on him from a discipline standpoint and letting him know how disappointed we were with him. And we, you know, it was kind of one of those, like the tighter we turned it, the more he was acting out. I mean, he had a new sister, he was failing at school, we didn't love him, he was a disappointment. So you can just imagine how a five-year-old would just internalize, I'm not worth that much. And it was just, our family was just derailing, right? And to have that kind of moment of truth, and what was really interesting was Pastor Jin's counseling to us in that moment wasn't, you guys need to like figure this out and we need to get Oliver a better school. He was like, who cares? Who cares if Oliver is back talking or, you know, you don't give him a timeout? Why don't you just focus on affirming him for 3 weeks and see if that makes a difference? Why don't you just treat him the way you would want to be treated? Don't stop worrying about being indulgent. Treat your son like the baby that you love. And that was really hard. I think we're still learning that. So I think that's what I wanted to share, is that one of the big kind of parenting moments for me was realizing that our children are just like us in some ways. And sometimes they deserve, you know, whether it's an ice cream cone or whether it's a, you know, an extra hour of television, like the expectations, it's not about being indulgent, but sometimes we as grown-ups need to kick back or need to be loved or need to be held or need to be told it's okay to just have a bad day and it doesn't really matter. And I think creating space for my children in our family where they are just as important as me and how they feel and that my home is safe and that it's an oasis for them, that was a revelation for me. So I think that kind of tied into Steve's story about conferences. And I'm learning, right? So I'm the oldest of three children. I'm the oldest of, I think, 15 grandchildren on one side of my family. I'm the oldest of 6 grandchildren on the other side of the family. I am the oldest child of 2 oldest children. I have more codependent family functioning that I like embrace in my being. And what part of what goes along with that is a perfectionism, right? Both Steve and I are not even recovering addicts. We are full on perfectionistic junkies. And I wouldn't even say we're not even on a spectrum of healing on that. Both of us are very dangerously achievement oriented, and the way that we put that into our children is pretty toxic, right? And so I don't know that we don't have that figured out. But what I do know is that it's important for me to feel really loved and cherished in my home by my children, by my husband. And it's really important for my children to feel cherished. And so I really try to focus my energy in a different way on just creating space to hold them or talk to them or affirm them or to be emotionally present with them or vulnerable with them in a way where you're not making them into grown-ups. He's not a grown-up, so you don't expect grown-up things from him. but that his humanity is really sacred and special and vulnerable, and protecting that is so important. So especially for my overachievers in the room, or those of you with kids coming or kids younger than ours, anybody who we actually have anything to offer to, all the older, wiser parents like the Allens have probably figured this out a while ago. But I think that would maybe be the thing I'd want to share, is just let them be loved. So I'll stop there. Is there anything else you want to say, honey? You want me to pass it back, Pastor Jen?